Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, joined as always by my co-host, Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings in California. And we have a wonderful guest with us today, Paul Justison, who we're going to get to in 1 minute. Really, this is a great, great show. Rob, how are you doing? How was your Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving was great. Great to hang out with family. We just got back from Hawaii. Everything is fantastic. Couldn't be more excited. We had a lovely trip and happy to be here. If nothing else, to talk about psychedelics today. As you know, one of my favorite conversations in the world, and nothing I like more than discussing psychedelics with other people that have had the opportunity to use them as liberally as I have. So let's get the show on the road, man. Let's talk psychedelics.
Absolutely. Yes. I was just going to say, I have to shield myself from that bronze tan you're exhibiting. It's very, very impressive for a guy our age to come back looking that good. But whatever the trick is, man, you pulled it off. So absolutely. Hope all of our listeners had a wonderful Thanksgiving. And yes, let's dive right in. The topic today is psychedelics. And Dan, let's get the music rolling, will you please? Okay, well, yes, we are talking psychedelics today. That is The Grateful Dead from March 24th, 1993, at what my buddies and I would call the Dean Dome in Chapel Thrill, North Carolina, the party capital of the world, according to my good friend Dr. Z, who may have been at that show, actually. And they break out Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. When I was at the New Year's shows run in 1984, when they broke out Day Tripper, everybody for years was talking about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, the Dead. Of course, the Grateful Dead have to play it. How can they not play it? It's the ultimate LSD song, for sure. And then all of a sudden, in 93, boom, the boys break it out. And the next thing you know, they're playing it all over the place. And I don't know about you, Rob, but I love that song when the Beatles do it. And I love it even more when Jerry covers it.
Yeah, I love it when they both, no matter who plays it, I love that song. And I'll tell you, that specific show that you just played was one of my great regrets, as I lived in Chapel Hill at that exact time in 1992. And I left Chapel Hill for spring tour with the Grateful Dead and went and saw every one of the March 92 shows, made my way back out to Utah. And, you know, I think I caught like 17 out of 20 shows in a row and did not go back the next year. I had a whole crew of friends in Chapel Hill, and they announced those dates. They're like, you're definitely coming, right? And I ended up going to Alaska to ski instead. And I missed those shows, and they broke out LSD. So a big miss for me on that one.
Yeah, well, you know, look, that happens. And many opportunities to see it again. And in other places, Phil and his band have played it quite a lot in recent years. It's just a great tune, and it really helps set the mood for what we're going to talk about today. And we'll have a little more music in a little while. We're not focusing on any show today, just a few random Grateful Dead tunes that have a nice LSD overtone to them. But our guest today, and what we're really excited to do, is talk with our friend Paul Justison, who is here. Paul, welcome very much to the Deadhead Cannabis Show.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul, there's so many different ways I suppose I could explain to people who you are. It centers and it evolves around psychedelics to some degree. So I'm going to turn it over to you and let you give us the lowdown on what it is you do and how it is you came to be doing it.
All right. Well, I think the spark that got me on the show is I finished a novel and it's just been released. It's called Lost and Found in the 60s. And it's what you call autofiction. In fact, I originally started out as a memoir, but I realized after a while there are some people who are very close to me I didn't feel comfortable writing about. So I decided to switch to fiction, to a novel, which gave me a lot of freedom. Freedom to play with the characters, freedom to play with the timeline, and freedom to increase the tension. And not, though, in any way to take away from historical accuracy, because I really wanted to write a novel that let people feel what it was like to live in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s.
And let me just jump in right there if I can, Paul, because in fact, that was, you were that guy. You're not just writing about it, and that's, I'm sure you're going to go with your story, but you were actually living there.
I did. I first got to the Haight in late 66. I dropped out of high school. I had a very difficult time in high school. I was actually a very good student, but I had many other problems in high school. I was quite radical, protesting the Vietnam War. I had a difficult home situation. And then I had a terrible breakup with my girlfriend, all of that. I can't deal with this anymore. Where will I go? Well, Haight-Ashbury. And so I went.
What year was this?
This would have been late 66 when I first got there, late 1966. And I struggled for a bit at first. But then I got a job in the post office, which allowed me a lot of free time to go to concerts and to very much enjoy myself right there in the middle of Haight-Ashbury. I lived most of the time at 2018 Fell Street. Which is just fronting on the panhandle. And after a while, which helped me write much of the story, I had a very serendipitous meeting. A friend of mine, back then, many of the chemists did not have tablet machines. So when they made LSD, they couldn't make tablets because they didn't have the machines. So they would buffer the acid with some kind of filler, and then they would have to cap it. And the chemists couldn't do all that by themselves, so they'd have what were called cap parties back in the day. And you'd have to get people who were somewhat together so they wouldn't fuck everything up. So I was invited to one of these because I was kind of known as a somewhat careful guy. That's not meaning I wasn't partaking in all the follies that we were having there, but I could be a little more careful than most people. So I was invited to one of these. And then it all fell apart because the organizer forgot to hand out gloves. Because when you're capping LSD, you're sitting there on a table and you've got the powder in front of you, you've got caps, and you're trying to, you know, put it into the capsules. And I was pretty careful. I mean, that's just me. I am. And so I was often brushing my fingers off. I mean, I didn't mind getting high on LSD, but I thought I was supposed to do this job. And so after a while, everybody was stoned, and the guy who was there was supposed to be responsible. He and I helped solve things a little, but they went off and were stoned, and I was sort of half stoned, a little frustrated. But I thought, well, I didn't want to make a mess of this. So I just carefully stowed everything, cleaned it up. And the next day, the only one sober and capable of delivering the stuff to the chemist was me. So I met him. We talked, and you mentioned earlier Osley and others. Well, there were other chemists. LSD was not an extraordinarily difficult thing to make. And there were some chemists who stayed way out of the limelight because they didn't want to be in the limelight. I mean, that's one failing of Osley. He was a great guy, but he brought a lot out of himself. Yes, he put himself so much out there. So at any rate, I began working with this chemist along with a few other people because they'd make the acid. And then they'd have a quantity, depending on how many grams they made. 1 gram's 4,000 tabs. They needed people to distribute it to other mid-level dealers who might get 500 tabs and then would sell it. So I became one of the distributors. And so that was my, my experience as a psychedelic revolutionary, or given that the legalization is moving forward with psychedelics all over the country, certainly psilocybin first, and hopefully LSD at some point. Maybe I should just call myself a pioneer.
So I got so many questions there. Oh boy, this is gonna be fun. Look, first of all, like, you know, this is, it sounds like pre-blotter paper. If you're actually, you know, pressing tabs and doing it that way, like how many micrograms, you know, per tablet? Like what were you guys doing when you say 4,000 hits?
Well, later on, the chemists were making tablets. This point, again, we were just think of a vitamin capsule.
Yeah, yeah.
They were giving us
gel caps.
Yeah, we were just making caps. The goal was 250 micrograms per capsule. That was the goal.
Wow. So this is no nonsense. Like one tab and you're pretty darn high.
Yeah. No, well, nobody back then wanted half a tab. I mean, there was no microdosing back in the day.
Oh, I know. But even when you think about, like, you know, like Goonie Birds in the 80s, you know, as far as blotter paper, those had like the 125, like right in the propeller. Right. So like a standard tab of LSD on blotter paper, at least like during the whole time that I was, you know, buying sheets or buying 10 packs, like 100 micrograms a dose was considered to be pretty standard, right? Like a 250 microgram dose, like that's enough to get you pretty high. I mean, it's not like you're doing like a pinky print full of crystal, but you know, it's a 250 microgram dose is you're high.
That's what people expected back then.
So you're handling this stuff, you're handling it without gloves, which by the way, like when you say, I mean, the casual user out there, when Paul says he was, quote, stoned, I think that is a gross understatement if you're handling crystal, without gloves. So,
well, we weren't handling crystal. It was already buffered. It was brought to us. I mean, you know, a gram of LSD is pretty small, and you've got to buffer that out so that you've got powder. So we weren't handling it. If we were handling the crystal, my Lord, we would.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know people that have made that mistake. You know, when you say you're the only one that wasn't stoned enough the next day to be able to make this run, I mean, I've got to think that, you know, anyone that's handling even buffered powder, you know, without gloves is probably pulling a fair amount of inadvertent micrograms into their system.
I had a buzz, but again, I was, you know, it's just, we all have different personalities. I was a careful guy.
Well, I know that, during my heyday of eating lots of LSD, your tolerance would also go up over time with frequent use. So there's times that, you know, like a 10 strip would be appropriate, whereas other times, like, you know, a tab would be appropriate. It all depended on, you know, kind of where you were in your daily usage.
Yeah, but let's not kid ourselves too, because even with that, I quickly discovered that, you know, there's no way you think you can, but there's no way you can ever accurately bring, whether, I don't care if it's on blotter, I don't care if it's mushrooms, I don't care if it's all distilled and, you know, put out in these candy bars that I'm finding these days. You do one tab one day and get here, and the next day you'll do the same tab and you'll be through the roof. At least that was always my experience. It was always hard to kind of find, you know, a way to make sure I was having a consistent experience.
You know, well, in my time, back in the day, we're talking about 66, 67, 68, you know, we had no manual as to what to do. It was all folk wisdom. It was all what your friend did and but the folk wisdom then was 250, great. You have a great trip. You don't take any more acid for a few days, you know. And the people that did, because there were people that did, they were getting a little further out now and not coming back. So, I mean, there really was a feeling amongst many of the people, no, I don't want to do it 2 days in a row. No, I don't. I'd love it, but no, once, take a break.
Well, it's very funny that you say that, though. No guides or references, because I'll share this story, but when one of my sons decided that he wanted to try mushrooms for the first time, his answer was to go online and start researching how much mushrooms should you eat, you know, to have a decent trip. So whatever information he got, and he and his buddy thought they were going to sit on the back porch one morning and eat some mushrooms and, you know, get up and walk around. And I came home a few hours later and they were just sitting there. I said, I guess the research didn't really work. And I said, no, I guess it didn't really work, did it? So, you know, again, it's, I just tell people, you know, start low and, you know, whatever. Once you're up there, there's no way to come back down until it's all over.
Yes, that's true. And it may take time.
So other questions for you, you know, when you were doing this, LSD was still legal.
Well, I forget the exact date. Through much of 66, it was still legal. At some point in 67, it was illegal. I forget exactly when. I think it may have been at the turn of the year, 66 to 67.
Well, I remember the classic picture of Neil Cassidy on the day that LSD became illegal with just the most bummed out, like, facial expression of like, ah, shit, the fun's over. You know, it's...
But it really wasn't for him. It was just beginning.
Yeah, well, he hadn't gotten on the bus yet.
But the reality was, for quite a while, it was still very difficult for the police to penetrate the scene. You know, the police had been, you know, raiding the black community for pot, and they've been raiding other, but the hippies were totally new for them, you know, and getting an undercover cop to act like a counterculture guy was not something that they were really equipped or had figured out how to do. And it wasn't, from my, you know, knowledge or experience, that they really were coming down hard in the area, in Haight-Ashbury, until they began to arrest people by accident and then pressure them. And some of them would, you know, become stool pigeons, whatever you want to call them. And they also later on, in fact, I remember this in late 68, there was an extraordinary, a very large bust because the cops found somebody that could somehow make believe he was hippie and send them in. And he kept asking on the street, could he get 5,000 tabs? Could he get 5,000 tabs? And when I heard of it, people I knew heard of it said, no. No one goes on the street asking for 5,000 tabs. This is not right. Don't touch it. But a lot of greedy people did, and they all got busted. So, I mean, the cops would come up with different strategies. But in the early days, they didn't know what to do. They couldn't, you know, they made it illegal. But how did they catch anybody?
But this was coming on the heels. I mean, like, unless you know the history of LSD, people don't realize that, like, you know, there was no LSD really. I mean, like, Hoffman invented, I guess, in 38, but nothing really happened for years after that. But it wasn't until MK Ultra happened at Stanford, where they started doing all the experiments and actually recruiting people to come in for the CIA's program, which is where, you know, Kesey first ate LSD, and it's where Garcia first ate LSD, and there's a handful of people that participated in the Stanford program, that coming out of MK Ultra was really when, like, the explosion of psychedelics happened in the Bay Area. Is that right?
That's my understanding as well. And there are many other, there are some people that were still in, that are around today that were involved in those programs. James Fadiman, who's the founder of the microdose movement, I believe had some connection with those and was there doing LSD experiments, and getting volunteers and doing and recruiting people in the hate. I don't know that it was connected with the MK Ultra. It may have been some other offshoot, but there were still, you know, in late 66, there were still people able to do experiments with LSD. And they were getting generating interest in it.
I mean, at that point, like, the whole idea of, like, tune in, turn on, and drop out hadn't even been thought up yet in 66. And, like, you know.
No, I think that was 66 when Leary did that.
Was it 66?
I think it was 66.
Okay.
I believe, pretty sure. Yeah, because the BN was earlier that year, that was his big thing, that when he came on stage.
Yeah. But I know, like, turn on, tune in. 65, 66 is when, you know, Ken Kesey was still living in La Honda. And was still, you know, like, wiring his woods for sound, you know, outside of Palo Alto before he moved up to Oregon. And, like, the original sort of pranksters, you know, pre acid tests in San Francisco, you know, pre-further bus cruising around the country and, you know, sort of turning on the masses. But, like, 65, 66, I look at it, as you said, like, the world didn't know what to make of LSD at that time. Like, you guys were, when you say you were a pioneer, I don't think that really resonates with the way it should. Like, there was nothing before that was happening like that. And, like, all of a sudden this, like, revolution hit of people getting high and seeing the world in a completely different way, where they're never going to see the world the same way again afterwards. I mean, like, to this day, I credit LSD for, like, so many amazing things in my life, as far as, like, I would not know otherwise but for, you know, the experimentation I did with psychedelic drugs as a young guy, that, like, I see everything differently to this day, and I'll never see things the same way again, right? And that, like, I think there's a revolution of young people that were, like, getting to experience that primarily by guys like you and the chemists you were working with. So, I mean, first of all, thank you. Second of all, like, talk about sort of the experience of being there on the ground floor when, like, a complete change in, like, mentality was taking place in the West Coast.
You know, I talk about that more, I think, in retrospect. And there, at the time, it was just so exciting. It was what we were doing. I wasn't thinking about it. I was very young. I mean, I was, most of the time I was in hate, the period we're talking about, I was 17 and 18. I mean, I was a little advanced for my age, but I was young. I was a little naive. I had some good skill sets because I was careful. I was organized. Not everybody else was. That's why the chemists liked me. I was on time. You know, not everybody's could do that. I wasn't on time if I had taken 250 milligrams, but I didn't do that on my working days. So I want to just pick up on another thing you said, though, that it really opened the consciousness for so many people. I don't think the anti-war movement would have grown to the large level that it did without so many of those people involved in that movement having taken LSD and then thinking about war, thinking about napalm being dropped on people. I mean, it really engendered a total different think about how do I participate in this country. Maybe I'm not going to drop out, but I'm not going to participate in that war. I mean, one of the reasons really the drug war started under Nixon is he felt they were losing so much of the population because of this, and the people speaking out against the war were because of LSD. So they would attack the black community for drugs to put them down because they didn't want the Black Panthers, et cetera. And they would attack the counterculture because they wanted to put that movement down. They didn't want the change in consciousness.
That's true. I think that's very true. And that's why all of these people who were, as you say, pioneers in the movement, you know, are really to be applauded, right? Marijuana is kind of a messy story. If you know, you really go back through American history and, you know, try and trace how it got to be where it got to be. But everybody knew about marijuana, right? It's like you said, like Rob says, marijuana had been around forever. It just was a matter of what your outlook was on it, whether it was an enlightened outlook or whether it was a, you know, a moral and, you know, you'll go to hell type of outlook or somewhere in between. And, you know, people could form their own opinions about it, but at least it was something. Reefer madness was may have been crazy, but at least somebody was acknowledging that there's marijuana out there and they were, you know, talking about it on whatever level. You didn't have a comparable movie being made. And I mean, now, I guess if you look at some, you know, really nouveau art people who took the whole tripping experience and tried to make a movie out of it, you know, you don't have that. You don't. It's not steeped in anybody's history or culture because it's like as Rob says. I mean, I guess if you want to talk about peyote and other things that Native Americans were doing and other cultures around the world who were taking various substances that would cause psychedelic effects of one kind or another, but those were always, you know, I think of that initially. You know, in terms of the movie Billy Jack, which I was a really young kid when that came out, but that was all about him and, you know, tripping and finding his own way. And we just liked it because he went around beating the hell out of people. And we thought that was really cool. But, you know, I mean, it was hard. It was hard to understand. And, you know, what was really the message was about LSD. I think at the time, probably just interpreted as they were smoking pot because I wouldn't have really understood anything more than that, you know. And now, you know, my kids, everybody knows about it. It's, I mean, everybody hears about it. It's out there. And I'm actually very happy about that because it means it's coming back, right? I make, now that I'm older, right, you make jokes about the teenagers and, but you know, well, if the teenagers are in it, they must not think, you know, that it's very cool, we're very cool or whatever, but you know, they love it and they want to dive right into it too. And I think for a lot of kids these days, it really resonates in a certain way. You know, I don't think it's been easy to grow up as a child in the last 20 to 30 years. And, you know, the way the world has changed and the introduction of social media and all the stuff that's, you know, really been, you know, just piled upon on them. And psychedelics speak to humans in a way that's universal across all timelines. You know, we all have problems. They may be different problems depending on what era we're in, but everybody has anxieties or stresses or whatever. And, you know, to see the way that this can, you know, I agree with Rob. So many of my most important life decisions, I sit and wonder how different they would have been had I never not gone, if I had never gone down that road, if I had never experimented and tried. And it's not the kind of thing I wanted to turn to my kids and say, hey, kids, you go off and do it too. But when they were the appropriate age, you know, and they came back and said that they were experimenting with it, I thought it was kind of cool and would sit down and talk with them to see if their experiences tracked with mine. And, you know, in some ways, no, of course not. But in other ways, yeah, kind of similar. You know, the realizations you make and the things that you think you finally discovered that you never realized before. You know, it's life changing.
I wonder if I can pick up on something you mentioned—the movie Reefer Madness. I remember if that's exactly the movie, but when I was in high school, earlier, freshman, sophomore, I remember we all had to watch this movie. It was black and white. And these kids would smoke pot, and the girls would immediately go out and become prostitutes, and the guys would immediately get a gun and go hold up a bank and maybe get shot, you know, something like that. It was, these movies were total propaganda. Yeah. But right. What it did, though, because when you then smoke pot, and no, the girls didn't go become prostitutes. No, all I wanted to do was relax and maybe have something good to eat or maybe cuddle more with my girlfriend. There was nothing wrong with it. And so the messaging, who trusted the government? After you'd watched those movies and smoked a few joints, you wouldn't trust anything the government said. And so if they were saying LSD is now illegal, you say, so what? So's pot. It's fine with me. So I don't know. The government's handling of all of this has been atrocious, and it still is. And it's only local initiatives that really are moving us in a better direction. And I'm very happy for that. Here in Oakland, where I live, our city council made psilocybin. They can't make it legal, but they made it something that the police can't, not supposed to spend any time on. And Colorado just passed a law, and I know Oregon has a law decriminalizing psychedelics. So it's happening at the local level, and there are other. There are many more pioneers now that are the pioneers of making it legal.
There are, and each generation has to have their group that's willing to take it on to the next level. And you know, it's nice to see that that this kind of thing continues. And look, I'm a big, huge believer in it, and I think that it should always be available. Although I will confess that I have some doubts. You know, I have a hard time imagining a dispensary where you can walk in and buy LSD, or where you can walk in and buy psilocybin and, you know, whatever limited quantities they'll let you buy it in. But basically, you know, let's say 10 hits of LSD or 5 hits of LSD or whatever it is. And then, okay, thanks, I'll go see you later. It's a drug that I think is very good, very important, and very useful for people to try. But I recognize that, you know, some of us who enjoy these kind of things, it's like roller coasters, right? If you like a roller coaster, it doesn't matter how tall it is, you love the roller coaster. If you hate roller coasters, you know, the sight of thought of even getting on a small one can really scare the hell out of you. And I think that when you have something that, you know, that causes a psychedelic effect, we have to be able to account for that. And that's where the concept to me of microdosing comes into play. And, you know, you have experts who are giving people proper dosages for what will work for them in an environment and a surrounding that will allow them to experience it in a positive way, or at least as much as possible. And I'm all for that. And, you know, I mean, yes, I you know, maybe with psychedelics, I, you know, like parents with alcohol, they say, you know, we can drink it, you can't, you're not smart enough, you know. And I wanted to say that about pot with my kids, and then I realized, nah, that doesn't work. But, you know, maybe psychedelics are important enough, right? Where you have to say, I'm glad that it's out there. And yes, I admit that I somebody handed me a dose. I had no idea what dose it was. And, you know, and I tried it and had a great time. But I just wonder in what your thoughts are, you know, in terms of a society where marijuana is smoked so freely. Can you imagine a society where psychedelics are equally as available and their use is as pervasive?
Well, you know, I think we ought to be open to experience and the evidence. You know, other countries are legalizing in different ways. The Portugal experience is something to look at. I haven't followed it recently, but they basically decriminalized all drugs. My personal feeling is somewhat akin to yours. I mean, LSD is a much more powerful drug than psilocybin. There's no question, especially if you're taking 250 micrograms. And I don't see a problem with that it being legal, but you have to get a prescription from someone who's a psychologist or a psychiatrist who's trained. I don't see a problem with that. Psilocybin to me is a much safer drug. I mean, I'll give you one of my psilocybin tales. I had to go to my draft physical in 1968. And I was lucky. I had not changed my address with the draft board, which wasn't something that was on my mind. And so I had to report to my physical in spring of 68 in Phoenix, Arizona. And already by that time, if you'd gone to your physical in New York City or Oakland, which Oakland was the place in the Bay Area, wherever you were in the Bay Area, you went to Oakland, you could pull any kind of trick. And by then, you were off to Vietnam. You were drafted. But I was lucky. I got to go to Phoenix, where it's much less sophisticated. And the proportion of freaks in San Francisco, in Arizona, was much less. So I had to strategize what I was going to do, and I talked with a number of friends, and my strategy was simply I checked into a hotel the night before and took a significant dose of psilocybin, knowing that by the morning I would be functional, but as long as I didn't clean up and shower and everything, I was going to look pretty weird. I was going to look out of it. That was just the natural reaction from taking psilocybin. And not, you know, trying to piece myself together. Well, I guess I may as well tell the whole story. So I strategized this pretty much. So I went into the draft physical looking like I was still, you know, I didn't wear any underwear purposely. Not that I don't wear underwear, but I knew you were going to have to go through a physical. And so they got very upset when we had to change into underwear and I didn't have any. So then I had to go around the physical wearing my jeans. Getting grief from all the other potential draftees most of the time. But thankfully, I am 6'5", and back then I was a little in shape, so I didn't get too much grief. And I just played with them. You know, I had a had to go to the audiology test, you know, and so I was supposed to respond to things. And instead, I just made up this ditty in my mind, Ho Chi Minh, Ho Chi Minh. And I was getting excited as if I was back there tapping on the thing. I'd hit the min, hit the button with every min. I played with them on do the optometry test. I just kept playing with them.
I love
this. And finally, I get sent in to see the psychiatrist. And he knew exactly what I was doing. And he just played with me for a while. But in the end, he said, look, I don't want you in the army. You'll probably sabotage things. So 4F. So I got my 4F and partly credited to taking psilocybin. And I purposely didn't take LSD because the next day I would probably not be functional. And I wanted to at least, and then they, who knows, they'd tell me to come back in 2 weeks or something. So it worked. And, you know, and my experience with psilocybin that night, was, I remember it was really quite something. It was very enjoyable. And eventually I went to sleep. I had the number of alarm sets, so I'd make it to the physical. So, I mean, you can use psychedelics for different purposes.
I love that. Okay. That is, that's not sure that that's one I'd necessarily recommend to people, but I certainly, I love it in your circumstance. And that's, you know, what better way to just go to the army and say, shove it, you know, here I am. And I know it, you know it, we all know it, and too bad.
Well, it worked. And to me, it was an immoral war. Whatever I did to get out of it was right.
I think most wars are immoral wars. Rare that we find one that you say it's a good moral ground to go kill people. Hey, so shifting gears a little bit, you know, being in the Haight, 1966, you know, height of kind of a revolution in consciousness and changing. It was also a revolution in music. Right. And it wasn't just, you know, obviously we're the Deadhead Canvas show, so we're big, you know, proponents of the Grateful Dead. But at that time, you know, that was the emergence of Big Brother and the Holding Company. It was the emergence of Jefferson Airplane. It was Quicksilver Messenger Service. It was Moby Grape. It was the Sons of Champlin. It was, you know, beginning days of Santana was, you know, right around the corner. Hendrix was still playing there. Monterey Pop was happening. You know, there was a ton of stuff happening there between what Chet Helms was doing with the Family Dog at the Avalon and, you know, pre-early days of Bill Graham. What was it like being in that zone, like where literally the entire world was kind of like tuning into the San Francisco sound?
Well, it was really exciting. And it was also, I'd say, like a community. Many of the theaters or auditoriums we'd go to were pretty small. The main two that we would go to in the early days were the Avalon, which I looked it up a while ago. I think it only held 400 people. And the Fillmore, which was a little further away, held maybe 800, 900. That was pretty, I mean, today, I mean, you go into stadiums where there's 50,000 people. And back then you'd go to a concert and you may know or have seen around most of the people there. So it really felt like it was not only the sound, but it was people you knew. So it was just, it was quite a community of like-minded people, very peaceful too. I mean, it was very different from where I'd been in Arizona, where there was often a threat of violence in social settings. But the Haight-Ashbury, at least at that time, I mean, later it changed with people coming in and preying on you. You'd go to the conferences and no one was hassling anybody. It was just extremely peaceful. The music and, you know, and again, I think I mentioned earlier when we were talking that one of my regrets, serious regrets, is so many of those, I went very, very high on marijuana and I really can't remember the concerts at all. I know I went to them, but I don't remember anything from them. But the scene, you know, it was just magical. You felt you were in a different world, a different community. And when we'd leave Haight-Ashbury to go any distance, you felt the difference. You felt you were somewhere else. You were out in Whitebreadville.
So even within San Francisco city limits, but just outside of the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, you're saying that you know, they had the establishment people living in the rest of the city, huh?
Oh yeah, well not very far. Well, I mean, to get from Haight-Ashbury to the Fillmore, you'd go through the Fillmore, which was then very much a black ghetto. And the relations between the counterculture types and the blacks were very good. I mean, there may have been some crazies in the Black community that would pray, but for the most part, I mean, there was a very clear acceptance that these people aren't racist. They're here. They're coming through our neighborhood to go to a concert. They're not bothering us. We're not bothering them. And I think as well, I would say that, you know, there's this whole notion of cool that people had back then. And that came from the Black ghetto. That wasn't invented by the counterculture. I mean, so much of what drove the counterculture wasn't invented by them. It's what we borrowed from other places. But the sense of cool, I remember going through the Fillmore and seeing Blacks get hassled by the police, and their way of just dealing with it was just, you know, it was just, it's not the old fashioned notion of Uncle Tom. This was totally different. This was just, they were on a different plane than the cops. They'd answer the cops. They'd be somewhat polite to them, but they weren't bowing. They weren't, not at all, nothing. So it was nice being next to the Fillmore in that sense. And I remember so many times I'd drive across the Bay Bridge and coming back, you know, you had to pay, you know, toll coming across. And there was a thing back then to pay for the person behind you. You'd pick out people. You'd pick out Blacks with hair and you pay for them. And then when you're going across the bridge, everybody waves back and forth. Or sometimes, in another way, you pick up somebody that looked really uptight and you get in front of them and pay for them. So I don't know. I'm going off on stories. So bring me back whenever you want. I'm getting lost going back to the day.
Well, outside of just the music, you know, the other part that I look at during that period is, you know, Ron and Jay Phelan, I think it just opened up the psychedelic shop that period.
Yeah.
You know, you also had, you know, the great artists, you know, whether it was Stanley Mouse or Alton Kelly or Moscoso. You know, there was a handful of Rick Griffin. You know, all these guys were totally changing the way you look at art and kind of the psychedelic work that you could actually put inside art that now has been picked up by, you know, some amazing artists that are alive today that I think, you know, that do poster art or do other, you know, psychedelic art that owe a great deal to these early pioneers that were all right in your neighborhood at the time. You know, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, I don't know how much you went to the psychedelic shop when it first opened, but I think that was, you know, relatively groundbreaking at the time as well as Alan Cohn's work, I think, on some local publications.
Actually, the place I remember actually more is the Print Mint. That was fascinating. That's where all the posters were hung up and you'd buy posters. It was right on Haight Street. I think there was a little counter in the middle and there's a counter in the back, but the walls were all covered with all the posters you were talking about. And that's where you could go in and buy them from whatever concert passed. They keep prints there. Psychedelic shop, I don't recall going in that much, but the Print Mint I loved. It was actually that and the Russian bakeries. I mean, Haight-Ashbury, before the counterculture moved in, was for some reason, I have never really investigated this, a lot of Russian families lived there. It was like many areas of big cities. You know, there might be in Chicago a Polish area or a Hungarian area. Well, the Russian area was Haight-Ashbury. And they later moved way out into the Richmond. But at the time, there were lots of these Russian bakeries. And so you'd get these pierogies. And having a joint and then going into one of these Russian delis and getting a few pierogies, it was really this incredible taste treat. Your mouth would just explode with this meat and onion and whatever spices they'd put in it. So I don't know. I have these odd memories from back there of just what attracted me. There was also this tiny smoke shop that was right at the corner of Haight and Masonic. Very tiny little shop, no bigger than, my little room here, that had all these foreign cigarettes. And back then, you know, people were still smoking tobacco, and we were. And it was a big thing amongst many people to go in and get these really odd cigarettes from Turkey or from England. And we'd walk around and smoke one was the Balkan Sobrania. It was a big thing. So, but I just don't remember the psychedelic shop. Maybe it's it was so prominent, I don't know. But the Print Mint, those little Russian bakeries and the tobacco shop. And then there was a nice theater. There was the Straight Theater where a lot of events happened. There wasn't much music there because it had a sloped floor. You know, it's typical theater with rays, so it's not very good for dancing. But there were a lot of events that happened there. It's just a hole in the ground right now. But
did you ever make it to any of the acid tests?
No, that was before my time.
Before your time.
Those were all really early 66 when I was still in high school. I would love to have, but No, I didn't get there till late 66.
That brings, I guess, to one of the great counterculture people, which we mentioned earlier, which is Owsley Stanley, and obviously Melissa Cargill, who kind of worked with Stanley. But I think all the LSD that was supplied to the acid tests came from those guys. And I know, as you said, they're definitely the more notorious of the guys out there, along with Griggs down in Laguna Beach, and a handful of others that were doing their thing. But between sort of White Lightning in the north and Orange Sunshine in the south, they're certainly turning on millions of people at that time. I know Owsley had a sort of an oversized reputation, but, as we talked about kind of in the preamble to the show, it did give rise to, a handful of bands eulogizing Stanley over the years, whether it was Steely Dan with Kid Charlemagne or it was with the Grateful Dead writing LSD Millionaire, after the headline came out after he got busted that he was the LSD Millionaire. So, Dan, maybe you've got a quick clip of that one for us to listen to, and we'll jump back into kind of the bigger names of the psychedelic movement.
Yeah, that song is just, too funny. That's just the boys having a little fun at Owsley's expense, LSD Millionaire, and becomes LSD Millionaire. And, he can always say that the Dead wrote a song about him, and that's no small nothing. But I think it just speaks to the fact that, the Dead were having such a good time, and they were at that stage of their careers. We've talked about it before when they were living in the hate. They were, Bobby was throwing water balloons on cops. They were young jokesters. They were out having a good time, and they were fun enough that they could pick up on something like that and quickly turn it around and make it. They only played it twice, both in 1966, and I think this one is a version from the Matrix Theater on December 1st, 66. The first time they ever played it was, I want to say, at one of the festival, one of the trip acid festivals on acid tests on maybe October 31st at the California Hall, if I remember correctly. And then they played it this time on December 1st at the Matrix, and that was pretty much it. I think Phil played it once or twice. Further might have played it once. J-Rad, I think, may have picked up on it once. But, it's one of those tunes that's a lot of fun, and it speaks to the moment, certainly.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a really, really fun time, for the Grateful Dead, and definitely having some fun at the time, their sound man's expense. So super, super cool. But I love when people, sort of covertly, like just the way, we started off with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, anyone that was paying attention obviously understood the acronym was LSD. But there was a handful of psychedelic songs out there that were, largely sort of couched in something else so as not to give away the true intent of the song, but very, very cool.
Well, you could be talking about Puff the Magic Dragon, right? Except Puff the Magic Dragon, they came out years later and said, no, it had nothing to do with marijuana. And I'm like, oh man, either you're lying or you're missing out on a great link in here, guys. But I would not be telling people that now. You're blowing a great marketing opportunity. But this really speaks to the time, right? I mean, nowadays we just take it for granted here in Illinois. All of a sudden you can walk around and if somebody's smoking a joint, you're not supposed to be smoking on the street. But, like the psilocybin out west, marijuana in a lot of places, including here, has been decriminalized to the point where I think for the average police officer, it's just not worth the time and trouble to issue somebody a citation for smoking a joint in public and then have to show up in court. And the judge is just going to slap them on the wrist anyway. But people, oh my goodness, I was taking the L today. I was at Wrigley Field today. You smell marijuana everywhere. It's in the air, as though, oh my goodness, this is some brand new realization. And yet, And so I go back to what I say before. I can only imagine it, you know, 10 years from now, if instead of marijuana, you know, you're getting on the L and the guy next to you is just taking a good dose of psilocybin, you know, and all of a sudden you talk about getting involved in a strange conversation, it could really get weird. But, you know, I guess from what you're telling us during this time period when you were living in the hate, that's kind of what it was like. People were just very open in their use, and it was not uncommon to walk down the street and see somebody coming right at you who was having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, now and then. I don't think we saw as many people out single, alone. I mean, there was a caretaking back then. Often people, part of the folk wisdom, if someone's going to take acid, they would do it with somebody or in a group. And maybe there'd be a group and there wouldn't be a monitor. There wouldn't be somebody staying safe. Or you could have someone. I went to a concert once, and a friend of mine wanted to drop before. And I actually, this is sort of an interesting story. Two girls and I, who lived near, and a very close friend of mine, were all going to go to a concert. And my friend decided he was going to drop just right before, which pissed off one of the girls because he thought we were going to, the four of us were going to have thing, two and two, whatever. It's going to be nice. Concert, smoke some joints, go out and have some fun. But Tony, that was my friend, that's what I called him in the book, because I used the scene in the book. He wanted to drop. So he took a full dose of acid. And then we were going to the Fillmore West, which was on Van Ness at Market. It was a larger theater than the original Fillmore at Fillmore and Geary. And I couldn't find any place to park, so I'm driving all around. Finally, I find a place to park, and when we get out, there's a series of low buildings with just glass fronts, about one story tall, that run maybe half the block, and the lights are on inside, and there's just all kinds of pipes and vessels inside, and then you look up and see it's a plastics factory. And my friend, who had dropped just before we got in the car to drive to the concert, which we're going from the hate to not very far, but it's coming on. And he gets out and he looks at all these pipes and he can't go anywhere. He's just pipes. And I remember the girls were kind of pissed because they didn't want to stay. I had to give them the tickets. And I also had to give them my joints because I didn't want to be babysitting my friend and have the cops harass me for any reason. And so I was stuck with my friend in front of this pipe factory for a long time.
But, you know, look, we've all been there, you know, after a dead show, everybody walks out and one guy sees something like, okay, come on, man. No, dude, look, no, really, it's okay. No, man, you're missing. It's right there. No, you don't see. And I mean, those are classic moments, right? When you're with your buddies and that kind of thing is going down, as long as you don't have anybody chasing you or anything. But yeah, it invites in a sense of fun and playfulness that I think, you know, by the time we all get, you know, into our late high school and early college years, you know, there's a sense that that almost has to be behind you now. You know, now you're having fun on a much larger level, on an adult level. And I think that, you know, this kind of it allows that playfulness side to come out a little bit and keep things on a much more even keel overall. And, you know, all I can say is that's your experience was, drastically different from mine at that age and for most of the people that I know. And I think that it's absolutely wonderful to have had an opportunity to grow up in that experience and kind of away from the culture that was being spoon-fed to the rest of us, where all of this was being acknowledged, but only on a level that suggested, no, you don't want to do it. It's bad. You know, they're all silly. Just that California, leave that alone. Don't, you know, and, you know, it took me, going off to the University of Michigan and doing a little experimenting on my own to, you know, finally see the light, if you will, or the truth, or whatever you want to call it. But it's here, and I think it's great. And, you know, we talked to a lot of people on the show, you know, who were very key and instrumental in the early days of the marijuana movement, and then some even more recently who helped pass a lot of the legalization legislation that we see. And, you know, there's kind of a sense of hats off to them because of what they've done to move marijuana and all of cannabis forward. But by the same token, I think it's only fair to acknowledge those of you in the psychedelic era who, you know, helped bring a little bit of normalcy to it, to the point where it wasn't just snuffed out, right? They didn't just come into San Francisco and say, that's it, we're shutting this down. We never should have let this cat out of the bag, and now we're gonna, you know, we're gonna cut it off. People learn the recipe, and at that point, you know, they can make it go forward. And there was enough of a demand that many people could do it. Enough people could do it that it grew into, you know, the culture that it is today. That, you know, I think that people who participate in the psychedelic culture, whether it's just, you know, once in a blue moon gram of mushrooms, or, you know, I like to take my acid on a regular basis, you know, there's people all the way in between. And more power to all of them, because I think that anybody who tries it demonstrates that they're, you know, willing to take a step away from everything that they've been taught and everything that people tell them the world should be. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, a little bit like Aldous Huxley, right? You're really unlocking these doors of perception and taking a step through. And a lot of people in our society, a lot of well-learned people, famous people, educated people won't have anything to do with it, and are generally scared by it. And I often wonder if that speaks more to human nature, that some people can accept the educated world, if you will, but it's much harder for them to have to be able to spend any bit of time focusing inward. And anybody who's taken any type of a psychedelic drug knows that at some point along the way, you will spend some period of time focusing inward, which I think for a lot of the healthcare professionals is the very thing about it that makes it so attractive as a microdosable type of treatment.
Yes, absolutely. I am really thrilled with the microdosing movement. In fact, I've been microdosing again recently myself. I think it's has great value. It's calming, gives you a little more focus. I enjoy it. I'm surprised. I never thought that would be the case. I mean, back in the day when we were taking mega doses and then I got out of it. So, well,
but I'll tell you, I think that that's for people, you know, certainly my age, and I guess I'm a few years younger than you, but not too many. Our experiences the first time we took LSD was, boy, we took LSD and it was really, we were out there, you know. First time we took mushrooms, boy, we were really out there. Maybe over time you learn to gauge a little bit, but eventually we all got to points in life where it just wasn't sustainable. You know, you have kids, you have a job, you have everything, and the opportunities just didn't, at least in my experience, lend themselves as readily as they might. But now we get to a point in life where kids are all grown up, kids are moved out of the house. You know, we're a little bit farther along in our careers. Some of us control our own destiny. You know, some of us are just very satisfied with where we're at, and, you know, are looking for things to do. And it was kind of an amazing experience in the last year and a half. I did a lot of traveling and seeing music with a good group of friends of mine. And although many of them weren't necessarily interested in doing it themselves, everyone's always really supportive. And, you know, it's a group that you can be very comfortable doing it with. And it just makes all the difference in the world for me. It puts me in a much happier frame of mind. It lets me really enjoy the moment and not get lost in everything else that's going on. And most importantly, if I'm going to see a dead show or dead related show or anything like that for a guy my age, it gives me a little bit of energy to be able to stand up and dance for a few minutes.
Well, I have great hopes for psilocybin. I mean, it's very, very much, you know, much more accessible drug. The chances, I mean, I think there is so much propaganda put out back in the day about the horrors of really bad trips of LSD. I think most of those never happened. I think it was just propaganda put out by the government. In fact, there was a book.
Wait, are you saying that Art Linkletter's daughter didn't really jump out of a 10-story window or something when she was on LSD?
Well, she may have, but the reasons for that may have been something totally different. In fact, there was a review of a book. I should have it on the tip of my tongue about a woman who wrote books about people having bad trips and their lives ruined, and it turned out it was all false. She created it all. There's actually a book exposing her. But getting back to the point, I think the chances of having a bad trip on psilocybin are really minimal, seriously, unless you took an extraordinary dose. I mean, like, extraordinary. It really minimal. And I think as psilocybin is more and more legalized across the country, I think it'll just move more in the mainstream, and it may have greater value in our society by getting people to be more aware and having some empathy. I mean, that's one thing we're certainly lacking in this country now, this empathy. And I see that both on the left and the right. I mean, I don't want to get into politics here, but we could sure use a mega dose of empathy in this country.
I agree with that. And but look, you know, there is come back. It's not just the fact that, you know, the next generation is getting tuned in, but like you say, the municipalities are now making it possible and open. And then all of a sudden you have manufacturers out there who say, what the heck, this, you know, I'm just like the marijuana guys, you know, 10 years before Colorado went legal, but they were the ones who were out there opening up those dispensaries and really taking everything out there. And now all of a sudden there's companies making, you know, infused chocolate bars with psilocybin. And they're putting it in a format and they're making it available to people again in a way where you don't have to feel like, oh, I'm eating these mushrooms and I can't let anybody see me, or boy, I really remember them tasting really bad, or right, whatever. They're making it accessible and available so that it's not really that hard. And I remember two things really fast from the Grateful Dead world. One, reading a book where Jerry Garcia said later in life that he would do mushrooms at least once a year just to blow the pipes clean. And then his roadie, Big Steve Parrish, sometime early on in the pandemic, talking about how with everybody, you know, having such negative mindsets, you know, being locked in their home and with all the stuff that was going on in the early onset of the pandemic, how important it would be for everybody to have a chance to do mushrooms and how helpful it could be to the population as a whole and really get our whole population through this period of time if people could use that, which, you know, for him and the Dead, you know, was a proven way to be able to snap yourself out of these doldrums and really make yourself energetic and upbeat. And, you know, I don't think it's a surprise that many of us were finding our love for the Grateful Dead and our interest in psychedelics right at the same time. You know, they really went together very nicely.
I think that's one of the greatest achievements of the Dead, almost on par with their music, almost on a par with their music. I mean, they were there with Further. They were, what I think you were mentioning as well, back in the day, they were working on the acid test. They were performing many of the venues where acid was spread around free to people. Their role in promoting the psychedelic movement is just extraordinary. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say it's almost as good as much of their music, but it's certainly another great achievement of theirs. And Osley too. I think I the chemist I work with, in fact, when I first started working with them, I asked them about Osley, what was their relation? They said, he's great for the psychedelic movement, but whatever he does, don't do it. We're low key. We are low key, Paul. But he was definitely very great for the movement. How else did he get spread so widely?
Right. No, that's very true too. Well, let me ask you, in the midst of all of this, did you ever have a chance to meet any of the members of the Grateful Dead?
No. Well, I walked by, I remember a couple of times their house. Their house was not too far from mine. I remember seeing them there, but I was never one to, I don't know. How should I say? No, I didn't walk over and say, hi, I'm Paul. But yeah, I saw them around.
You didn't bump into them at the local supermarket or something?
No, the local supermarket would have been the Safeway at the end of Stanyan. But no, I didn't see them there. I saw Janis Joplin much more often for some reason. I don't know why. I saw her frequently.
I saw in your book you made mention of seeing her drive by in a car.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I saw that was actually, I remember that scene and I put it in, but I saw her many other times. I don't know why, just around. Maybe she was more striking and maybe I'm more attracted to women. I mean, that's maybe part of it as well. So I noticed them more. But I don't think I ever saw Grace Slick. I saw a number of in fact, I think it was Jorma that lived right near me for a while. He had a Citroen. Whichever the members of the airplane had a Citroen lived right near me, and I saw him quite frequently. I think it was Jorma, but I'm not sure. No, the Hate then was, the other thing we never mentioned, the other thing that was really vibrant at Hate back then, the farm workers, you know, one of the first unions that were really trying to help the farm workers was the United Farm Workers, Cesar Chavez. And their main protest was at the Safeway on Hate Street at Stanyan. And so the farm workers were out there every day. So there was this political kind of energy that happened in the Hate. And it was right at that area where the other side of Stanyan was where the diggers would have their free soup kitchen. So, I mean, there was so much going on in the Hate beyond just you think of psychedelics and free love. We had the farm workers there with all their signs and they're talking with people. Don't buy grapes. And then you go across and they're the diggers serving up hot food. you know, it was, there was a lot going on beyond just music and drugs.
Let me ask you, Paul, we're going to run out of time here soon, but I want to just kind of swing back to the book a little bit. Just kind of synthesize, if you can, what's the story about? What's the message you're given in the book?
Well, I don't think there's a big moral message or anything. The biggest message I want to give with the book is, here's what it felt like to live in Haight-Ashbury then. And the vehicle for that is a coming-of-age story, and I certainly model it on my own life. Though, and the character, the main character, resembles me a lot, but it's not exact. I didn't do everything the main character did, and there are things I did that he didn't do. But it's modeled on my life, so you can see the arc of somebody struggling, getting some proficiency, learning a lot, and then having a resolution and maturing through the process. And I just happened to place it in one of the more iconic periods in the United States history, the 60s, and the place, Haight-Ashbury, which was the psychedelic center of the universe at the time. So I think it's a very compelling story just for the place. But I think I've read a lot of books about the time, not everyone for sure, so I may be missing one. But most of the books don't have a pace. They don't move along quickly. And it was such a time of energy and people moving and doing things and dancing. People were just sitting around and doing nothing. Well, now and then, I guess you got quite stoned. But there was a lot of energy and movement. And I tried to convey that in the book. I think I succeed.
Let me ask you this. Where can our listeners go to find it? Do you have a website or somewhere where they can go and find the book?
Well, I have a website that's very simple. It's my name, pauljustison.com, which is PAULJUSTISON.com. But also, it's published by a real publisher, a small one. So, you know, we don't get a lot of press because it's a small publisher and they don't have a lot of funds. But it's available anywhere books are sold. If you go into your local books, and that's one of the things I wanted. I love bookstores. So you go into your local bookstore, if they don't have it, the terms for it are good and the bookstore will be glad to order it. So that's what I prefer. You know, obviously they're the major e-tailers and it's there, but I'd like to support local bookstores. So that's what I'd be happy. Walk into a bookstore and ask for it.
Excellent. 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 Well, Paul, thank you. Thank you so much. These stories have been great. You know, for guys like Rob and I, who, you know, came of age a few years after you did, but, you know, found the fun along the way, it's really kind of reaffirming and entertaining to hear what came before us. And you know, from the guys who had boots on the ground, you know, back at, you know, really ground zero when it was all just taking off. And, you know, it's nice to be able to find people such as yourself who weren't just there, but who were willing to stop and tell the story with us and obviously in more detail in your book. And thank you for your time. It was great to have you with us today.
And thank you. And if I can just add, it was a pleasure being with you. You guys also have this depth of knowledge. And a couple of times I've thought, wait a minute, did I remember that? You know, so it's fun to talk with people who know about it as well. Just as much as you cook a good meal, to have people who appreciate good food eat it. So I really appreciated you having me, and I had a good time here.
Well, if nothing else, Paul, we are students of history. And when you take your psychedelics as seriously as we do,
I can see that.
Always fun to have people on that that know the subject matter and have written about the subject matter to allow, you know, nerds like us to ask the questions that we do. But you know, you've nailed multiple different subject matters that are close to our heart, being the city of San Francisco, you know, the music of San Francisco, the psychedelic movement, and the late 60s Haight-Ashbury. So between those four, you've created the perfect storm for Larry and I to ask questions today. And we greatly appreciate your participation in allowing us to sort of rapid fire at you, you know, fun things about stuff that we hold dear to our hearts. So thanks so much for joining us, and glad you had a great Thanksgiving, and thanks so much for stopping in.
All right. See y'all.
Thank you for everyone listening. On our way out, we do have a little more Grateful Dead music for you. This is another example of the Grateful Dead interpreting the great psychedelic songwriters of the time, the Beatles, the Dead from Cal Expo in May 19th, 1992. I'm sure Alex was there, and
I was there.
Rob was there. And that this, to me, this may be the greatest psychedelic song of all time. And certainly the Beatles wrote it and made it famous, but boy, the Dead really capture it. Tomorrow never knows. So enjoy, everyone. We will talk to you soon, and enjoy your cannabis responsibly.
And your psychedelics.
Listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
99.9% of our DNA is identical. It's a 0.1% that truly makes us different and unique. And that's what the show is about. Find out that 0.1% about your favorite guests. Find out what music they like, their first cannabis experience, and even what their room looked like growing up. But more importantly, or as important, their journey. Learn what makes them unique on Everything Is Personal.